Welcome to Murder with the Misses. I'm Darren.
And I'm Amy. And today we're going to talk about Susan Hamilton. This is another Oklahomaan. So let's go Hillary Duff style. Back to the beginning.
Okay.
Dr. John Baxter Hamilton met Susan Shibley in 1985 at a friend's birthday party. They had an instant connection. They were both divorced and had previous kids from their marriages. People close to the family said that she was a good mother, beautiful, and smart. She was strong in her beliefs, and John was drawn to her. John was a high society OBGYN who ran an abortion clinic on the side. They got married, and Susan started running the clinic 2 days a week.
Here in the Bible Belt, especially, there were regularly protesters, and they got a lot of threats.
Right, a lot. But Susan never wavered or got too scared. She was strong in her pro-choice beliefs, so she wouldn't get rattled by the hate that they'd receive. In their personal lives, it said that John spoiled Susan. He gave her a Porsche on their wedding day, they took luxurious vacations, and had lavish dinner parties. He would often give her expensive gifts.
Oh, life was rough.
It was rough. Yeah, it sounds like they were living the dream. But too often our stories start out like that. We're going to fast forward to their 15th Valentine's Day together on February 14th, 2001. This was a Wednesday, so John had surgeries scheduled that day, and Susan had a meeting at 9:30 that morning. John left early for his first surgery, which started at 7 a.m. He came home before his next one to give Susan her first Valentine's Day card for the day. His second surgery was at 9, so he went back to the hospital and performed that one and returned home again. But this time when he got home, it was around 10:45, and he found Susan nude on the bathroom floor in a pool of blood. She had one of John's ties around her neck, one of his ties underneath her head, and she had been beaten so badly that her face was unrecognizable. Her hair was still wet from the shower that she took when she was getting ready for her meeting, so it seems like she may have been surprised by her attacker. John called 911 at around 11:06 a.m., and he told operators that he was a doctor, you know, to let them know that he knew what he was doing. And he told her that he was hanging up to do CPR and that he was unable to get a pulse. Police stated that when they arrived, John was wearing a suit with his shirt unbuttoned, no tie, and he didn't have shoes on. They found a heart-shaped box of candy with a stuffed bear, a Valentine card with a red envelope that had Susan's name on it, some other cards, and two rolls of ribbon. In his 1996 Jaguar XJ6, they found another card with a red envelope, and in the trunk of his car was a card from Susan. Just a week before Susan was murdered, someone left a wanted poster at the abortion clinic saying, a reward in heaven will be bestowed on anyone contributing to bring this murderer to justice. Both John and Susan had been receiving threatening phone calls, their home was vandalized, and someone had tried to set fire to the clinic. Brochures were even put at her kid's school, saying wanted, dead or alive.
There's nothing wrong with, you know, feeling strongly in something, but not so strongly that you aren't, you know, that you're affecting these poor kids. Well, I mean, why did the school even allow it?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. I would be irate if I was a parent.
Yeah.
That's so sad. Another anti-abortion group applied for a permit to protest in front of the couple's home just days before the murder. But there's a big leap between aggressive protesting tactics and murder. Their whole thing is being pro-life. So while it wouldn't make sense that someone from the group would take someone else's life, it wasn't out of the question. Theories of robbery also came up while the police investigated that day. They did live in a well-to-do neighborhood and lived a lavish lifestyle, so that could make them a target. But there were no bloody footprints leaving the bathroom and no sign of a break-in. It also looked like the blood was smeared in some places, like someone had tried to clean up, which is also not something a robber would do. The wet rag was still left in the pool of blood.
I would think that if a random robber broke in and killed her, that they wouldn't, you know, take the time to try to clean up and around the blood. And I mean, what was the point?
Exactly. What's the point?
You know, I mean, I don't know. That don't make any sense to me.
Me neither. But, you know, it's theories that they have to go through. And this is all day of. This is just things that they're going through while they're on the scene. So it's very fresh. So they have to start looking into, could it be this? Could it be this?
And they said that it was a bloody rag, but up a little before this, it was, had one of his ties around her neck, had a tie right on her, behind her head.
Right.
So where'd the rag come in?
That's what they're saying. Someone was trying to clean up. They got a rag because they were in the bathroom.
Yeah.
So somebody just grabbed a rag. And they actually, when they were taking things from the scene, they actually took cleaners and stuff that they thought were used to clean it up so they could test them.
Okay.
And as the true crime community knows, the first one that they generally look at in cases like this is the spouse or significant other. Based on his timeline, he would have likely had to murder her in between surgeries that morning. But the time frame was short, and his staff said that when he returned for his second surgery, he wasn't acting out of character at all. They found it hard to believe that he could go home, kill his wife, and return like nothing ever happened. But the neighbor and Susan's friend, also named Susan, pulled one of the police aside and told him that a week before the murder, Susan mentioned that John was getting a lot of calls, calls that he wouldn't even answer. When she asked him about them, he told her it was just a patient that was down on her luck and he was helping her out. But Susan found out that this patient was an exotic dancer named Nina. And according to their cell phone bill, there were close to 100 calls between Nina and John. He explained this as the patient that he was helping out, and she was having a tough time mentally, even having thoughts of self-harm. So John was counseling her and had never physically cheated. Everyone close to the couple, even Susan's ex-husband, said the police needed to find Nina because she probably did this. That John could not have been involved because it was so out of character for him. No one had ever even heard him raise his voice in an argument. Maybe they had an affair and John broke it off when Susan found out, and that would be motive. Or maybe he wouldn't have an affair and Nina was jealous and wanted Susan out of the way. Either way, Susan was talking divorce. Susan's daughter said that the night before she was killed, she told her that she was sad and lonely.
You know, it sounds like she was done with the relationship. I mean, fair or not.
Right. She just wasn't happy. And there's never been proof that he had an affair, but there was proof that he had gotten 2 lap dances from this exotic dancer.
Is that how he was helping her out on down on her luck? He was going to the strip club?
Actually, it's funny you say that because a lap dance is $20. Mm-hmm. And the first time he got a lap dance from her, he paid her $100. And the second time he paid her $80.
Ah, so he was going to the VIP section.
It sounds like it. How do you know what a VIP? No, I'm just kidding.
he's going to the champagne room.
There's a song about that, you know. Yeah. There's no sex in the champagne room. Mm-hmm. But either way, she's definitely unhappy. And the Valentine's Day cards showed that as well. It is stated that John's card to Susan said, "I know this has been a difficult time for us. We are important, loving, caring people together. My life would be incomplete without you. I love you." So it showed that they were having issues. But it is reported that one of the cards from Susan to John read, "I bought my cards 2 weeks ago, so I guess maybe they don't seem as appropriate now. But I do love you. Have a good day, Susan." And when I was researching, there are images of a card that had a standard message from the card company, like they do. But she drew a line from that message and then hand wrote, "Obviously, I bought this before last Monday."
Yeah, she was done.
She was done. Yeah. And it's sad because they talked about how great they were together and everybody just said how much he doted on her and that they were just, they seemed so perfect all the time. They were together constantly.
You know, I wonder if she like caught him at the, you know, like.
No.
Like, no, I wonder if she like followed him like to this club or whatever, wherever.
There were no reports that she did.
Well, no, obviously, because she's not here to report it.
Well, I mean, she was open to her neighbor and open to her kids. I'm just saying neither of them reported anything.
Yeah.
But you never know. People be doing stuff. Yeah. Now, when the first responders arrived, they witnessed the CPR that John was doing on Susan that day. Remember, he's a doctor. He had one hand on her chest and one on her stomach and was doing compressions that way, which I don't even know if you can call those compressions at that point. And I'm not a doctor and I've never had medical training, but I have seen Grey's Anatomy and that is not how you do CPR. There was also no indication that he had tried mouth to mouth. Whoever had killed her had cracked her skull open with some type of object that was never found, by the way, and bashed her face into the tile in the bathroom. Now, had he tried mouth to mouth, he would have had blood all over his face, and there wasn't any. So they put John in the back of the police car because he's looking very suspicious right now. He was seen scraping his knuckles on the screen and banging his head on it. So when I say screen, I mean that little partition that's in between the front and the back seats to prevent inmates from hurting the officers as they're driving. And it's made of steel or metal.
Yeah, and that, you know, and that's what I didn't get when I was researching this and everything, when they said that he was scraping his knuckles and banging his head. It's like, mm-hmm. What are you covering up?
Exactly.
Are you covering up where she fought back?
Defensive wounds.
That's it. Yeah.
Exactly. It looks suspicious.
It looks suspicious as hell, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that was the first conclusion that I came to as soon as we saw where, you know, read where it said scraping his knuckles. I was like, he's fucking covering it up.
Yes.
Yeah. You
know? Yes. And that's exactly what they thought, too. That's when their, like, red flags really went flying.
Yeah.
Because who does that? No, or, not an not innocent a,
not
person.
A, sorry. Not an innocent person.
Definitely not an innocent person, for sure. Now, when they took him to the station, and he was in a waiting room, or waiting in a room. I guess you can't call it a waiting room. He was waiting in a room. They watched him on the cameras. And he kept checking his shoulder like it was injured. Now, we know sometimes when you do CPR on a loved one, you can do damage to your shoulders because it does take a bit of force. So it's not too far out of the realm of possibilities that he could have been injured in that way. But when they look at his clothes for evidence, they notice fresh scratches on his hands and arm as he's undressing. But he had his airtight alibi with that very tight timeline. So they looked into that, and they found a gap. His second surgery that started at 9 didn't actually start until 9:40.
That sure opens a bigger window.
Right.
But, you know, like you said, yes, if you perform CPR and everything else, you know, that takes a toll on your shoulders and shit like that.
Right.
But
when you're doing it properly.
When you're doing it properly. Exactly. I took CPR class. So I know how to do it, and you don't put your hand on your stomach,
It does nothing.
No, it don't do nothing, but.
No. He was half-assing it, for sure.
Now that's come out, because I remember the part, you know, where they said that he was gone for such a period of time that they ended up having to call him or something, right?
They did.
Yeah.
They did. We're gonna get to that.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm jumping in.
It's okay. Now, when they asked the nursing staff why it started late, they said that it's because John was late coming back from his house. So, another red flag. Dr. John was arrested that day for her murder. And no one who knows him personally believed it, even Susan's own kids. With John now in jail, one of Susan's friends went to their house to get some clothes for Susan to be buried in. When they were looking in her underwear drawer, she found Susan's jewelry. Police theorized that John hid the jewelry to make it look like a robbery. Investigators hired a blood stain expert named Ross Gardner. He determined that a lot of the blood on John's clothes fell under the category of impact spatter that could have happened when he was half-assed in that CPR. But remember, he wasn't wearing shoes. His shoes were next to Susan's body because John said they fell off when he was doing CPR. But the blood expert said that whoever was wearing the shoes, the left shoe in particular, was there when Susan was beaten. He said that the inside and front of the shoe, the spatter on it, shows that it was in motion. It was like a spatter event that could only have happened while she was still alive. He also saw similarities in some of the shapes of blood on John's shirt. The shape matching the wound on Susan's head, meaning the murder weapon, touched the shirt. Since they didn't have a murder weapon to compare it, the blood expert actually had a picture of her wound and a picture of the stain on the shirt, and when overlapped, they matched up. When they investigated the Jaguar, they found strands of Susan's hair and pieces of her flesh on the steering wheel, driver's seat, and driver's side door sill. This was all presented to the jury when his trial started 10 months later. Prosecutors said they possibly argued when John came home in between surgeries, likely when he read her card to him, or he read the card, and that he used the neckties to pull Susan to the ground and then kill her. He was then trying to clean up when he was paged to come back to the hospital because he was late for that 9 o'clock surgery. And so he had to leave before he could finish. Then he came back to discover her body, and the story proceeds from there. So you were right that he was so late to the surgery, they had to literally page him to be like, where are you? Because they said patient was on the table ready to go under, and they realized he wasn't there.
Yeah, and that makes so much more sense.
So this all adds up, right? John has not said a word in the 10 months he waited for trial. His defense team said in court that there was no investigation outside of John, that they laser focused on him and didn't investigate any other possibilities, which we've seen that many times before. But John took the stand too. He said that their troubles weren't as bad as they were portrayed to be. He said after the incident with Nina, he started therapy to try to earn Susan's trust back, and she even agreed to go with him. He denied a physical affair, and Susan believed him. Hell, the prosecutor in the case believed him on that one, too. When asked if he was trying to scratch his hands in the police car to cover up anything, he said he was just frantic and scared. When asked if the scratches on his arms were from Susan fighting him off, he pointed out that if he had had any scratches on him from her, that they would have found evidence of that under her fingernails, and there wasn't any.
Okay, and that also makes sense.
That does. That makes sense. You can't scratch somebody and not get their skin under your nails.
But he also had a big timeline where they had to call him
to he back also for was surgery. Quick to bring that up, too.
Exactly.
He had an answer for that. It's he had like an answer for everything.
Yeah, it's like he, you know, knew what to do.
Seems like it. But remember, he was late for his 9 a.m. surgery. He said that the surgery nurse had told him that the surgery before his had started 30 minutes late, so he thought he had more time before his would be able to start. That's why he even went home. He thought he had more time to give Susan her Valentine card before she left for her meeting at 9:30. And what about the hair and tissue in his car? He said after getting off the phone with 911, he had to move his car so that the ambulance could get in. He says in his heart, he knew she was gone, but he wasn't going to give up on CPR. Okay. Sorry, it was hard to even say that.
Yeah, because okay, I'm not going to give up on CPR, but let me go move this car.
Yes.
So the ambulance can get in.
And the CPR was shitty anyways, so we weren't doing anything with it. Ugh.
I was sitting, you know, I'm sitting here reading it.
He did say that he was nervous and shaking, so he wasn't doing any good with the CPR anyway. But nervous and shaking does not mean your hands completely separate and you are on two separate parts of the body pumping. You know what? Okay. I just can't with this guy. When asked why he put her jewelry in the underwear drawer, he said, "I don't know. I mean, because it was out there in view, I guess." Now, since the only people coming to the house would have been the cops and the EMTs, I guess he was assuming that they would just come in and take whatever they wanted. That just confused me. But he also hired his own blood spatter expert, who threw doubt into all of the prosecution's expert testimony. Like, that without a murder weapon, you can't say that the stain on the shirt and the wound on Susan's head were made by it. And the blood spatter in his shoe could have come from him doing CPR. So they had an answer for everything, too. On cross-examination, though, the prosecutor asked if there was anything missed by the state's expert or the Oklahoma City Police Department. The expert paused, looked at the defense attorneys to object, but when they didn't, he started talking. He said that there was a blood stain inside the right cuff of John's shirt. A blood stain that was consistent with showing it could only get there and in that pattern when John was beating Susan with the murder weapon.
Oh, shit. He dropped a bomb on him.
His own expert.
Hey, at least he came and he actually told the truth.
He did. Yes, that's a nice moment to see. Because he was paid for by the defense, so...
Well, it just shows that you can't be bought off.
He could not. This guy could not be bought.
Yeah.
He just blew up his client's entire case.
Yep.
And no one in the courtroom was expecting that.
It was really good because he, like, made it look like they didn't have nothing, and gave them the opportunity.
He gave them every chance.
And he's like, all right. Your fault.
I'm going to go for it.
Yep.
And he did.
Yep.
And like I said, they called it a Perry Mason moment because you could hear a pin drop in that courtroom.
I wonder how many objections they did after that.
It didn't matter. It did not matter. The defense lawyer still tried to say that it happened when he was doing CPR, but at this point, nobody was buying it. And no one had mentioned this before. So there's no way they could have prepared to defend against it. So the jury took all of 2 hours to find John guilty. 2 weeks later, he was sentenced to life without parole. The judge told him at sentencing that the jury was disappointed that the death penalty was not an option, so he should consider himself very lucky. John believes blood spatter evidence is junk science. Since multiple people can look at the same spatter and have such different reports of how it was caused. He hired a new attorney and appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court. He failed each time and is still in jail and maintaining his innocence to this day. He also made a little history during this case, too. He was the first criminal in Oklahoma County who was charged for his stay in jail while awaiting trial. He was ordered to pay $11,000 for his accommodations. Oklahoma is one of about 40 states that have this pay-to-stay program, which is very controversial. Some say that inmates choose to break the law and should have to foot the bill, while others say it just creates more debts that inmates can't pay after they're released and perpetuates the cycle of being in and out of the system when they get arrested for not paying the fines. It's been quite a case.
And that's true. You know, the whole, you know, pay to stay or whatever, you know, that, mm-hmm. I agree with people that say that, you know, it basically anybody that's ever been in prison or whatever, once they get out, it's like they can never get ahead.
It's so hard.
They can't ever get ahead in life. Look, if you did your time and everything. And I'm talking about like guys that went to jail for stealing something. Not necessarily guys that murder. I'm talking about guys that stole something. If they did their time and everything.
Let them go.
Let them go. But when they get out, then they owe $26,000 for, you know, all this stupid shit and everything else. Yes. And then, so now they're having to pay every month. And by God, if they miss one month, they got a bench warrant. And guess what? Go right back.
Right back. And just start accumulating more fees.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a cycle. So I can see both sides. Like, I think if you choose to break the law, you're choosing to things like this. If you know this is a thing and you still choose to break the law, you're accepting this as your fate.
Yeah, but they're also making them work.
They do make them work.
They put them on road crews and everything else. So, yes. I mean, why doesn't that go into effect? Why doesn't that take off of their bill?
Right. Right. Exactly.
But
that's the thing.
Anyway, I'm getting off topic of the actual story here.
Well, his lawyers even were talking about it, and they were saying if he was going to have to pay for it, he would have paid for a lot better accommodations than he got. Like, it's a hotel, and you could just upgrade your room.
The prison Hilton of Oklahoma.
Exactly. And Oklahoma, I found out also, is known as the prison capital of the United States because apparently we have more prisons and more prisoners than any other state. So I don't know what we're doing around here. Well,
I know we got some shitty ones here.
Well, we have a lot of private ran prisons.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of judges and people like that that will place people in these prisons to make money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like they make friends or get kickbacks or, you know, things like that.
And a lot of prisons anyway, you know, they're government funded anyway.
Yeah, state prisons are for sure owned by the state.
Well, even federal. Some federal are too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's true. But yeah, this was another Oklahoma one. This was a sad one. This guy did get caught, though. He, like I said, he still says he's innocent. I don't think her kids fully believe that now. They did at the time, but I can't say that they do now. And he's still fighting every day to prove his innocence.
Yeah, whatever, buddy. I'm not believing it.
Well.
But yeah, I think that they pretty much nailed this one right here on top of the head.
Got it.
Yep. All right, well, guys, we appreciate you guys listening. Join us next time. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube or go and like us on Facebook. Check us out on Spotify and all the other ones.
Tell your friends.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.